Getting back to Faslodex, what about the issue of the dose of the drug? There's, you know, at the dose we give it, you basically don't see any side effects. And so the questions are raised, well, why not give more? And would you see greater efficacy?
Right. And there's been a little bit of exploratory work, you know, looking at higher loading doses. And it's not yet clear that there is an optimal loading dose or plan. But I think many of us now talk about, or at least often use, an upfront loading dose of 500 rather than 250. And some people give it at day 1 and day 14 and then go on to, you know, routine monthly injections.
And again, our patterns of care study suggests that a lot of the researchers are doing that, not quite as common in community practice.
Well, if I may, part of the reason for that, and I'd have to go back and refresh my memory of the study schemas, but a lot of the ongoing clinical trials actually have built in those loading doses without testing the loading dose.
Right.
They're simply assuming it.
Yeah, and a lot of the researchers are part of those studies, so they're kind of, you know, it's rubbing off on their practice in general. But in a way, you know, when you think about it, it also ties into the issue of right now we only really have data in postmenopausal women, and the premenopausal women, it doesn't, at this dose, seem to be active. As far as my understanding is, it competes for estrogen, so that sort of makes sense. Are there any situations where you might use ovarian suppression plus fulvestrant?
Well, for a premenopausal patient who gets the fulvestrant, in reality, the majority of them should have been rendered menopausal. And either menopausal because their status post-adjuvant chemo and it's been a few years and their ovarian function has been suppressed, or they're already through one or two lines of hormone manipulation for stage 4 disease. And, you know, frankly, it should have included ovarian suppression. So I suppose for the patient who has not had a BSO and still has functioning ovaries and has progressed after ovarian suppression with tamoxifen and an AI, you would have to ask yourself, should I continue the ovarian suppression when I begin the fulvestrant? And my answer is I would. I don't see any reason not to.
Another thing that's kind of interesting that's being looked at in clinical trials is combining an aromatase inhibitor and fulvestrant. In some of these studies, the patients who are, for example, on an aromatase inhibitor and then maybe they respond or whatever and then they progress, instead of stopping the aromatase inhibitor and starting the fulvestrant, they just keep the AI going. Again, this sort of competitive estrogen concept. Is that something you ever do in your practice outside of trial?
No, it's not. But I'm looking forward to results of such studies.
Interesting. What are some of the new research concepts that are being tested with fulvestrant, particularly the issue of combining it with other biologics?
Well, certainly in the CLGB, the thing that we're most interested in is the possibility of combining anti-estrogen receptor type therapies with other targeted treatments. For example, Hal Burstyn is chairing a trial for us that's randomizing patients to get fulvestrant or fulvestrant and a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. In this case, lapatinib, which targets the HER family, HER1 and HER2. And there's really nice, elegant preclinical data that illuminates the crosstalk between the ER pathways and the HER family pathways for signaling and makes the argument that combined blockade could be useful. So this is an exciting trial that we're just getting open.
Any other biologics? What about trastuzumab and fulvestrant?
Well, again, I mean, all these things need to be studied, and the lapatinib trial essentially does that and more because lapatinib, of course, is a HER2-targeting drug with, if you will, promiscuity in terms of HER1.